When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
On Giddy Up, it's time for the debate.
From thestraight.com.au, and boys, he's written some controversial and some interesting pieces over the last week. I speak of Brent O'Brien. G'day, Brent.
G'day, Gareth. How are you?
There's never a dull moment in the sport of thoroughbred racing.
No, there's always plenty going on in racing politics. It's also obviously a busy time of year with in the thick of the autumn carnival action. So plenty to write about at the moment, plenty going on in the wagering space as well. And yeah, it's all there on thestraight.com.au.
And the Jack Jumpers, you're a proud Tasmanian. Can they win a championship tonight, or is it tomorrow night? It's tomorrow night, isn't it?
Tomorrow night, it'll be a very big day for Tasmania. It's obviously been a thrilling series and really captured the imagination. I happen to be on the plane back from Melbourne on Sunday night. I didn't go to the Jack Jumpers game, but there were plenty of Jack Jumpers fans on there, and weren't they pleased? So it's great it's been great for Tassie. I mean, it's probably hard to explain to the rest of the country, but yeah. Tassie doesn't get in the national stage very often. We obviously made the Sheffield Shield final, which was not quite what we wanted, but I think it's been a great couple of weeks and great buzz around the place, especially within the Devils being announced and, 170,000, whatever it is, members signing up, their $10 putting in to support the AFL team from 2028.
Just on that, do you think that they will build a stadium there in Tasmania, or Jackie Lambie will get her way? What do you think will unfold there? Because it's important for, I think, all sporting fans in Tassie.
Who knows? There's obviously haven't got an official government formed yet from the weekend from the election. It looks like a Liberal government will form a minority government with three of Jackie Lambie's people involved there. And Jackie's been obviously pretty strong in her opposition to the stadium and what they want to do. So I would hope they would build the stadium, but my feeling is it's a lot more to play out yet, and may drag on a little bit more, and maybe the fact that it might take a couple of more years than they think it might take to get it off the ground, because Macquarie Point's still sitting there like a big asphalt car park.
All right, then, and from the great tip-off, the one and the only Mickey Gannon. Hello to you, Mickey.
Yes, good morning, Brad. Morning, G. Just keeps on heading up, this racing. It's unreal. I love it. What a time of year. The basketball, the Jack Jumpers, and the rugby league, full flight, and even the AFL. It's all happening, G. What a time to be alive.
It is a great time to be alive, and there's plenty happening in racing. We've got the Australian Cup this weekend. We've got the final day of the Rose Hill Golden Slipper Carnival before we head to Randwick for the championships. And, of course, not far away is the Easter sale. So we'll discuss all of that as this hour unfolds here for the Wednesday debate. But the first category for our Wednesday debate is Zach Purton, the best participant to listen to in racing. I interviewed him yesterday. Every time I have a chat to Zach, he's excellent. He's always got a strong opinion. He doesn't really care who he upsets. He says it how it is. And he's very, very talented, of course. He's one of the best jockeys in the world. And he can come out with a big statement. And every time I have a chat to him, I seem to learn something. And I find him really interesting, Brent. I think he's terrific for the game.
We love a combative sports person.
Yes.
In Australia. It's one of our favourite genres of sports people. And Zach is that and a bit more. He's a master at playing the game. Obviously a master on the track, positioning himself, the way he rides, all those things. Like he's a world-class jockey in that department. But where he is beyond most of the people I've ever seen, his ability to play the game off the track too, and talk the talk and put others under pressure and work the game. And that's been a really key to success in Hong Kong, not diminishing his ability on the track, but his ability to work the room, to talk to people, to needle and unsettle his competitors in a way which is completely, not nasty or anything like that. It's just the way that he talks about it. It's just Zach's natural nature. Yeah, as I said before, he's a master competitor, and that's really given him an edge in what is a really competitive market, and that's what's made him, what's helped him become one of the world's great jockeys.
Mickey Gannon.
Love it. Yeah, he's fantastic. Love it. Also comes down to a lot of the people that are doing the interviewing, G, getting the best out of these racing participants, and full credit to you. But you can slip me that 50 later.
All right, then.
But what I will say is there's a few others in the game that I like. I love hearing from Mick Price. I love hearing from Chris Waller. They're probably two names that come to the top of my head as well, that they just speak freely. But they're really thoughtful as well in their pieces. And that's what I enjoy about Zach.
I think we're very lucky in racing that we've got a lot of polished media performers. I think the young guns like a Sam Freeman, Michael Kent Jr. I'm going to miss out on someone here. I think Bruin Baker is always entertaining. James Cummings is exceptional. I love chatting to Jimmy. We've got so many like interesting people, and I think that's what racing continually needs to do, doesn't it, Brent, to have the stars of the show continue to market themselves in a way, because if you can get people engaged into what they're saying and they're the superstars of the sport, then it's only going to be better for the industry.
No, exactly right. I think what racing does have an advantage of compared to some other more team-orientated sports is that because most of our people are sort of operating on their own, they're effectively privateers trying to promote themselves and work for themselves. They've become a very good spokesman about their own product and what they do. And it's something that's probably got correlations with motorsport as well. Motorsport's very good at doing that because, you know, these kids grow up in motorsport and they have to, from a young age, have to talk to the sponsors and all the people and all that sort of stuff. It's similar with racing, right? You hop off a horse as a jockey when you're 16, 17 years old, you've got to talk to the connections, and then you might have to do an interview, and then you might have to. So I think, you know, I'm in terms of media talent and how people develop that media talent, it's rinse and repeat. You keep doing it and get better and get better and you get better. And this is a sport that enables that. And it hasn't had a high amount of media management in it, which is completely different to the other sports. And I'm talking, you know, footy codes or cricket or whatever else, where you have people who talk in sound bites because they don't want to, you know, get the team in trouble or whatever else. And they basically, you know, talk about, you know, platitudes and nothing else. I think the key is for our participants is because they're exposed to interviews day after day, and because they, they get on the radio and they'll do an interview with you and an interview with someone else, and they'll go on the TV and they'll do that, and they'll do their videos and they'll do their communication. They get very good at this art of verbal communication, and that's what's enabled these guys to express themselves in a way which is not, you know, which is actually interesting and gives us something to talk about, as opposed to probably the trouble in other sports is that they're pretty much coached not to say anything interesting whatsoever.
And Zach always gets like, he'll get people talking after I've had it. Like our social media team, our digital team love him because he will always say something that will ignite debate in the sport of racing, which is always healthy whether you agree or disagree with it. And I know it would probably never happen, but watching the Formula One and the popularity in Melbourne regarding the Formula One, and that comes off the back of the Netflix series. Like if you had that, and I think Hong Kong's probably only, I think Sydney could do it, Melbourne could do it to a degree, but Hong Kong would be the perfect place to do it if you did a series like they did with the Formula One. And you had a camera behind Zach Purton, and if J-Mac went there and Huey Bowman and fighting for rides and taking rides off your fellow jockeys. I think it would just be must-watch TV there, Mickey Gannon, because there's so much that goes into it, and the theatre would be unbelievable.
Yep, it'd be absolutely super, G, and I'd love for them to do it. Racing like needs that injection, and hopefully we get it one day.
Yep. We'll take a quick break. This is a Wednesday debate, 0499 736 736, to join our conversation. Plenty still to discuss on this Wednesday morning with Gareth Hall, Brent O'Brien from thestraight.com.au, and also, of course, Mickey Gannon from The Great Tip-Off. We might talk about parliamentary privilege, and that's been in the news in Melbourne this morning, especially with the AFL. And Mark Latham made some headlines recently, the Maverick MP based in New South Wales. Welcome back to Giddy Up, Gareth Hall, with you on this Wednesday morning. It's 20 minutes past 8, Eastern Time. Brent O'Brien from thestraight.com.au, and, of course, Mickey Gannon from The Great Tip-Off with me on this Wednesday morning. I was fascinated to read an article that you penned a couple of days back there, Bren, on the straight.com.au's website. It reads, Maverick MP Mark Latham has used parliamentary privilege to describe Racing New South Wales chief Peter Volandis as all tip, no iceberg, and unleash a tirade of criticism on his performance in both his racing and rugby league roles. Now, we can't comment on this because it's with parliamentary privilege. So Mark Latham is an interesting figure. He loves his racing, but that was interesting to read there on your publication there, Brent.
Yeah, just to just sort of clarify that, Gareth, we can report what goes on under parliamentary privilege. Parliamentary privilege is the concept that parliamentarians can speak with freedom of speech without reference to things like defamation laws and stuff like that, because they're within parliament. And outside of parliament, we can report what they've said. Commentary on what they're saying becomes problematic because, you know, it becomes in the sort of realms of defamatory. So we won't offer comment specifically on what he said per se. You can read straight.com.au what you want if you want to get a read on that. But I think what it does indicate is, I guess, that there's a few little threads coming away from the broader support for Peter Volandis and for Racing New South Wales and what they're doing. The Rose Hill aspect, Mark Latham wading into the Rose Hill issue, and he's an ATC member and a horse breeder and a horse owner, so he does have a bit of skin in the game here. He's significant because we know from history that Mark Latham doesn't let things go easily, and I think probably we'll see Mark continue. He's continued to question people about both the Rose Hill deal and Racing New South Wales' deal with the country race clubs as well. He's put some stuff forward around that as well. The Goulburn story, which is something we've covered quite extensively in the last week with the Goulburn race course. Goulburn Club will determine next Tuesday whether they effectively hand over ownership to Racing New South Wales of the land of their club in exchange for a $10 million grant, which would enable them to put extra stables on there. So that's become quite a sort of political issue in New South Wales racing about why that's happening. And, you know, it's probably, I think Peter Volandi spoke to us during the week and said, the fifth club that Racing New South Wales will be doing a deal like this with. And whether it's a positive or a negative that that Racing New South Wales is sort of taking over the land, the ownership of the land of the clubs are sitting on. And I think that getting back to what Latham's talking about here is there is definitely some political pressure going to be brought to bear on the New South Wales government about Racing New South Wales's dealings. Rightly or wrongly, but it's all about providing extra scrutiny on what Racing New South Wales have done. And as I said before, Mark Latham won't let it go easily. Yeah. We can expect to hear a bit more about this.
Just on the purchase of race clubs and the properties there that the race clubs own by Racing New South Wales, I think that's a positive for racing. I think that the jurisdictions should have control, if they can, of the land. Because I could never really understand that the race clubs are there for racing, and I know there's a lot of race clubs that racing loses their money, and the other parts of their business actually makes them money. But I can never really understand why the race clubs have to pay for the track curators and pay for the upkeep of the tracks when it should be, I think, Racing New South Wales or Racing Victoria or Racing SA or Rawood that does that. I think sometimes that race clubs and jurisdictions aren't on the same page, and I think that is detrimental to the game, Brent.
I think it speaks to a broader challenge about what the role of race clubs are and what the role of the PRA are and where they sit.
Yeah.
While part of what Peter Volandis has said is the strategy behind acquiring these race clubs is to provide, I guess, a barrier against anti-racing forces going forward, acquiring, controlling stakes in clubs or shutting race courses down, which in theory sounds logical and fine. The challenge is what that does for the local community if you no longer have ownership of your race club. Now, a lot of race clubs, particularly in Victoria, sit on Crown land, so this is not an issue. It's effectively a lease arrangement. But with some of these clubs that own their own land, the challenge is trying to, I guess, develop and continue to make money out of it. The challenge within New South Wales specifically, Gareth, just to point to this without getting too deep into the details, is that a key part of club funding in New South Wales, which is different from how it operates in Victoria, is that the TAB revenue has funded the clubs. All right. So it's important to remember that because, as we all know, the amount of money sort of eked out of TAB, particularly Parramatta TAB, over the past 10 years has gone down significantly, and these clubs are now finding themselves without the funding that they previously had through that way.
And they can't, just on that, so they can't get sponsorship like you see a lot of the country clubs in South Australia and Victoria these days sponsored by Ladbrokes or Sportsbet. That can't happen there in New South Wales.
Well, it's just the ways that they can make their money. Exactly right. So I think that they're increasingly turning to events and all those sorts of things to run those aspects. And so it's put them in a position now where they sort of have to go to Racing New South Wales and say, what can we do about this? And one of the solutions Racing New South Wales has put forward is say, hey, look, give us control of your land. We can work out the best way to utilise that. We'll lease it back to you at what's called a peppercorn lease, which is basically a nominal small amount of fee for a long period of time. You guys can run the club, make your money that way, and you don't have to worry about the overheads of developing the land or worrying about upgrading facilities. I said, in theory, sounds a good thing, but the challenge is that the control then goes to a central body and away from the local community and away from the local clubs, and that's what some people are concerned about. The question is, longer term, is how do these clubs continue to do this? I mean, this is one of the challenges that the ATC have faced with Rose Hill, is ongoing. They've had this challenge around diminishing or flatlining revenues, increasing costs, because that's just what happens in this world with increasing costs. You end up with clubs in situations where they're, they end up in poor financial situations and having to make decisions which are difficult decisions. And the Rose Hill decision is one of them, where they have to make the decision to go, oh, well, we're better off selling and redeveloping that land and making money out of that and putting that into something else and actually having control of what we're doing. But you've got to wonder how much control the clubs actually have and whether there's a better way in order to fund these clubs, in order to continue to make sure that we've got that breadth of presence within race clubs in Australia.
Mickey G, what's your take on that? On Racing New South Wales buying the land of clubs like Gosford?
Yeah, it's a tangled web, G, because I think it speaks to lots of clubs out there. They want to run their own race, their own communities. It's important. I don't know enough about it, though, to be honest, G, in regards to... I think it's a double-edged sword sometimes because, if Racing New South Wales owned all these and a couple were failing, what would be the first thing they would do?
They would sell them.
Correct. So we're saying
but that's what we're
buying them so we don't sell them.
Yeah, but Valenti's...
But what would be the first thing you'd do is sell them. So I don't know. I don't know enough about it, but just off the top of my head, it doesn't quite make sense to me.
Well, it's never made quite...
has challenges.
It's never made sense to me how... the race clubs who, like, from a revenue point of view, don't make the money that they used to with the wagering landscape, because they used to make a lot of their money, like 15% of on-course turnover, for instance. And that was when everybody was betting with the tab. You go to the races and you'd bet with the tab, you'd bet with cash. But now everyone bets on their phone. So that revenue stream's dried up. But they still have to pay for the track curators, and they have to pay for the upkeeping of the tracks. I can never quite understand that, Brent. And like, they have to pay for, like, some jurisdictions or some clubs have to pay for barrier attendance. Like, I think that the governing body should be in control of all of that.
It's interesting how much it differs from state to state, and how things are worked out. So it's quite complex. The sort of, I guess, you're not looking at just one business and comparing to another business. They're different businesses and the way they operate. But when you've got some of the biggest clubs in this country saying that they're operating, they're racing at a loss, which the MRC have said repeatedly that, they lose money on racing, on running racing. Well, what's their business and what's their idea? Now, the MRC have obviously found different ways to make money, which is their prerogative. That's fine. But, race clubs should be running race meetings. And if they can't make money out of their core business, then what are we doing? And somewhere along the line, the model's broken.
Yeah,
exactly. Spot on. The model's broken. And the fact that every, different clubs have different models, just that says enough, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's a confusing world that we're living in. It's 8:29. Let's take the news. Welcome back to Giddy Up. This is a Wednesday debate. 0499 736 736. She's already making headlines. I've seen a couple of TV stations and TV shows do stories on the filly out of Winx by Piero, and she'll be the star of the Easter sales, the famous English Easter sales, which will be kicking off in just under 2 weeks' time on the 7th and 8th of April. It's on a Sunday and a Monday this year. Guy Mulcaster was the man that purchase Winks, of course, at the Magic Millions sale. He's recently inspected, of course, this Winks filly, and he joins me each and every Wednesday morning. We record our Breeding Bloodstock and Banter podcast on a Wednesday morning, and this is what Guy had to say about the Winks filly.
She's everything everybody expects her to be. Same head as the mother, good athletic filly, and she's got a big, strong ass in her. I could imagine that Mr. Zhang would like to have her on his mantelpiece, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And there'll be numbers of other people have actually had a few international phone calls over the last couple of weeks about the filly. So it'll be interesting to see exactly what plays out.
Now, Guy said to me, Brett, I wouldn't get any change out of $3 million. But the question is, and the interesting question, is who's going to buy her?
Yeah, and this is an article which I'm actually writing up at the moment for The Straight, which will go up today.
Well, you can quote Guy now. What's that? You can quote Guy now.
I think it's an interesting one. I think a lot of discussion has been about the cost of what she might cost. And I think $5 million is the number that, you know, people kept putting on it because that's that psychological $5 million that that people talk about with, half brother, the Black Caviar, who cost that much, you know, 2013. You know, so that's sort of a bit of a, you know, a ceiling that people put in their brain about what a horse is worth. The most expensive filly in Australia, substantially less than that. So she'd break all records if she was get to that level. But she's creating substantial international interest, Gareth, as you alluded to, and as Guy alluded to. So
it's the Japanese. I would imagine the Americans would be wanting to be involved with this filly as well. So. It's going to be interesting there, Mickey Gaddon. She's probably not going to live up to the expectations of her price tag, but it's going to be an interesting bidding war.
Yeah, they're going to want deep pockets, G. That's for sure on certain. Yeah. I can't wait. It's going to be really interesting to see who comes out on top there.
And is there any chance that any of the owners of Winks will try and buy this filly, or do you think that they might be blown out of the water by some of the big international buyers?
I think I think Debbie Capetis is probably would be up there because we know how passionate Debbie is. Yeah. But given her own pedigree page, the Ingham's were never scared of throwing some money at horses back in the day, including $1 million horses. So you wouldn't be surprised if Debbie is one of those ones there, and that maybe if she comes together with a couple of other people to actually work on that one. Or the ones I've got on my list just for reference.
Who do you think will buy it then, Brent?
I would think in Japanese interest, Katsumi Yoshida and Northern Farm would be probably a slight warm favourite, given that their love of international mares, Group One winning mares, their involvement in Australia before, which is been ongoing, over the years through their involvement with Arrowfield. The filly could stay at a race in Australia, but would probably long term end up in Japan. They've bought these brilliant mares from Australia before. When you think about, you know, Yankee Rose and She Will Reign and Mystic Journey and all these horses that Northern Farm have purchased, so they're the ones that probably most in the gun from a Japanese point of view. But Mitsu Nakashita, the very well known, you know, global traveling trainer, he's been able to have a look at her, and on behalf of, we don't know yet who he might be bidding on behalf of or who he's looking on behalf of, but he represents a couple of major owners who have bought Australian horses out of Australian mares before. So that's fascinating, that point. This American sort of new player, John Stewart's come out. Yes. He's out in Australia at the moment. He's talking about buying her. He's been dealing a lot with Coolmore of late. Coolmore themselves, of course, you can't rule them out because, you know, Tom Magnier has been the biggest buyer of yearlings at the top end in Australia for some years now. And you would think that, you know, this filly has grown up on their farm by one of their stallions out of a mare that's obviously very close to them, having spent a lot of time there. That'd be important. Yulong, obviously, Mr. Zhang, you know, is obviously one to be keen for. From a local point of view, you know, Debbie Capetis is probably one, a Chris Waller-led syndicate. Would that involve Coolmore? Who would know? You know, Guy Mulcaster probably would have more of an idea than anyone else, I suppose. Yeah. Gay Waterhouse has put together syndicates before to buy big horses like this, whether she would be involved, who knows? John Cavalieri, of course, the man who bred Winks and who's, has got a natural connection with that family and has the means to pay for it and doesn't mind putting his hand in the pocket for a high price yearling, especially a yearling filly to sort of add to the broodmare band. And now, a couple I'll add into the mix. Seamus Mills is not scared of buying expensive filly. It's probably a little bit beyond his means, but he's bought plenty of a few million dollar fillies over the last few years and does like buying mare. And Tiako were obviously highly involved at the top end
Yes.
at Gold Coast as well. And so, David Ellis could be involved as well. So they're just some of the names sort of bandying around about who might buy this filly. And it'll be fascinating. I think we'll see the big boys fighting out the top. And I think we might see certainly a record price for a filly in Australia and might even get beyond that $5 million to the highest price ever for a yearling in
And
Australia.
people need to take a deep breath. Oh, this is a ridiculous amount of money for a horse. But you've got to remember, these guys, most of the people buying these horses are billionaires or close to being billionaires. So $5 million is like $500 to them in a way. So it's going to be interesting. I'd love to see Mitch Beer put a bid in, Mickey Gadden.
We can arrange it. Yeah, we definitely will.
We'll get a bid in.
Get
it up, Cindy Kim. We'll see if we can just, like, we'll put the first bid.
There'd be no point getting the syndicate together. We'll just put the first bid in and it gets blown out of the water.
Yeah.
Just for a laugh.
Yeah.
Underbidders. We can call all friends.
Underbidders.
Yeah, geez, I was stiff to miss out on that Wings filly.
Like 4.8 million, yeah.
Yeah. 8:38, Gareth Hall with you along with Mickey Gannon and Brent O'Brien. We'll take a break. We'll come back with plenty more. Here with Gareth Hall, Brent O'Brien from thestraight.com.au, you and Mickey Gannon from the great tip-off for the Wednesday debate. We had to go on slipper on Saturday. Usually whoever wins the slipper is a short price favourite to take out the two-year-old horse of the year. Lady of Camelot was successful. She was second in a blue diamond. What price, Mickey Gannon, is she to take out the two-year-old horse of the year in this country? Or do you think Storm Boy has still got something to say about that?
Yeah, I think she's favourite now, G, probably $1.80, because I think she may continue. I've read,
she takes on Storm Boy in the size.
Yeah, so that'll make it interesting. Yeah, it's up for grabs because there could be a horse out of nowhere that wins the size and the champagne as well, and then could take them both over the top of both of them. So interesting to see how it plays out. It's definitely not cut and dry, Bren.
No, I wouldn't think so. I think, Lady Camelot has been the best two-year-old because of, she's been second to Blue Diamond and won the Golden Slipper. You can't deny that. And it would take something significant. Storm Boy comes out and wins the Inglis and the Champagne by 6 lengths each, then maybe it's a different story. But I can't see on face value how, given their clash on Saturday, how you could take anything away from Lady Camelot. I know Storm Boy probably wasn't in the best position on the track, but she beat him fair and square. And, she deserves her number one ranking at the moment. And, we've seen it a few times in this Golden Slipper of late. It's been a bit of a modern trend of the fillies knocking off the high-priced colts, and that's the beauty of it. I'll leave the debate over the 2 kilo allowance to other minds, I think.
Well, it's a good debate to have. It depends on who you ask. Like, I know that Wayne Hawks has been big on this, Mickey Gannon, and it's just that it's not fair that these fillies and these mares continue to get a 2 kilo allowance on the boys.
Yeah, well, from a formalist point of view, I think we've got to stand up and take note of it a little bit more. It's because what they get in the results, right? So I don't know what they do with it, G, but I think the stats are there. These horses are performing well and getting the job done, aren't they?
I'm just trying to find who won the 2-year-old horse of the year last year. Was it Shinzo or Militarize? That's how bad these awards were run last year. We didn't know what they were on. To start with,
I'm pretty sure it was Shinzo. Karen.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was Shinzo, but let me double check on that.
No, I'm trying to find it. I thought Militarize, he dominated he was pulled out of the slipper and won the champagne. Yeah, so
it was Shinzo.
Yeah, so she'd be $1.50 to take out the
two-year-old
of the year. Yeah. I know why they moved the Australian Cup, Mick, to this weekend, so you'd have the All Star Mile into the Australian Cup, but it's just bizarre that we've got the Tancred and the Australian Cup on the same weekend.
Yeah, it just goes. Yeah, we talk about it nearly every week, don't we?
Yeah.
The programming and the conflicts between the best horses lining up in different states. It's disappointing as a racing fan, to be honest, because you want to see the best horses racing against each other. Bren, you've proposed several suggestions, and what's the solution?
I'm not too sure, but 7 of the past 20 Tancred winners have come to the Australian Cup. That won't happen this year. when you sort of think about the way that the race is structured, it's just this dysfunction of the pattern. We go on and on about it.
I've got a solution.
Good man.
I've got a solution. So what you do is you get rid of the futurity. You only have the CFL Stakes. You have the All-Star Mile and the Newmarket Day on the same day and call that Super Saturday. And then you have the Australian Cup when the All-Star Mile was 2 weeks into the to a race like what we're seeing, the Tancred on Saturday. I think the Melbourne Carnival brand goes for too long now. I don't think it can go in and run into to the Sydney Carnival. So, and I think for being based in Melbourne, racing gets a chance. It's only got a small window in the summer / autumn, and that's before the AFL season starts.
Yeah, couldn't agree with you more there. You've got rid of one Group 1, just got to get rid of 23 more, and we're back to where we should be in terms of the amount of Group 1s in this country, Gareth. So
yeah.
I think that there is that window there. I think it stretches too long. I think Australian Cup will be a terrific race, notwithstanding. But you've got to think about the whole product and the way that it works. And the fact you've got, yeah, and we don't have that many quality Group 1 level 2,000 metre, 2,400 metre horses in this country that we can afford to have one over 2,000 and one over 2,400 metres, you know, up at the other end of the Hume Highway. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And it's frustrating because we're going to have unworthy winners. The Tancred has been a really great race over the years. It's clearly been diminished through a little bit of positioning, but also because of the focus put on the Queen Elizabeth Stakes over the years in Sydney. And that's just what happens. You value one race over another and put more prize money, and people tend to focus on that one. But it's a pity because the Tancred has been a great race, and it's just its relevance is fading by the day. And on Saturday, we're probably going to see a fairly tepid version of it, Mick.
Hey, G, yep. You're the man in the know. Are we going to see a post-impressionist in the Tancred?
Yeah, I think so. And this is the situation that's frustrating, because this is what it does when you've got such a jam-packed schedule. So you get a horse like a Buckaroo and a post-impressionist, for instance. Buckaroo, a little unlucky. They look at the Tancred nominations and it's worth $1.5 million. And all of a sudden they go, well, maybe we should go to this race now. Like it's an afterthought in a way. And the same with post-impressionist. Like he won impressively there on the weekend, but there was no real... Like he came into the thinking of Nick Williams straight after the race, after he was interviewed on Channel 7. But because of the lack of depth, you could say, in a Tancred, this is why these horses are all of a sudden thinking about backing up a week later. If you had a Mr. Brightside or a Pride of Jenny or a genuine Wait for Eight superstar in a race like this, then they wouldn't be going there. They'd be planning their campaigns a little better there, Brad and Mick. So that's why.
I'll also say with post-impressionist, yeah. G, and you're spot on, because Buckaroo fits that profile. I just think the win was so easy.
Yeah. Like,
proper easy. Probably would have felt like more like a barrier trial for the horse, that they kind of think, well, let's just go around again. And it's a very winnable race. And I'm not sure what horse would be scaring them off. But
Tom Kitten, he's nominated.
I'd say there's a horse here that we didn't mention, and I know this is a debate show, but there's a horse here going around that's really caught my little mix. It's in the Tancred, but it's also nominated for another race. Just for the punters, get your black books out. That'll go around on Saturday, and that'll be very hard to beat wherever it goes, G.
Even in the Tancred?
Wherever it goes, G.
Okay, I love it. We'll take a quick break. We might discuss at the end of the Queensland Carnival who will be Australia's best horse. This is a Wednesday debate. Gareth Hall, Mickey Gannon, and the great man from thestraight.com.au, Brent O'Brien. Welcome back to Giddy Up, Gareth Hall with you, Brent O'Brien and Mickey Gannon. At the end of the Queensland Carnival, who will be Australia's best horse? Great debate. I think after the spring, I think Without a Fight and Parrot Trees would have been the horses. Think about it, fighting for that number one spot. I think with our team, it was Without a Fight. Mickey Gannon, who do you think will be the number one horse by the time we end the Winter Carnival?
It's grayed me up completely, G.
It's confusing, isn't it, now?
It's like... if Imperatrice comes to Sydney and wins the TJ Smith, then I'm going to go with her.
Do you agree with Johnny O'Neill? It's a two horse race.
Well,
or maybe two and a half.
Mr. Brightside's there. Pride of Jenny's there.
No, I'm talking about the TJ Smith between.
Oh, the TJ Smith. What were the horses he mentioned, G?
Well, you mentioned most of them. and he went through the market and he said,
"Well, it's interesting because
got
no
chance. I think Sunshine and Paris he gave half a chance to Bella Nipotina if it was a heavy 55, but he basically said it's between I Wish I Win It and Paratrice.
Well, here's a here's the thing. If I Wish I Win comes out, and it wouldn't shock if I Wish I Win wins by three.
Yeah.
But it's the horse has had one run. Like, I don't know. I don't know what you do with it all, G. But I think I Wish I Win. You know what? Off that one run, I think I Wish I Win will beat Imperatrice. And then I don't know how you then say Imperatrice is a better horse.
Well,
so
Via Sistina, you got her. Like, she could win a Queen Elizabeth. She's an Australian now. So
I find it hard because you've got sprinters, you've got milers, you've got horses that go beyond that, stayers, you know, like I find it difficult. Probably need a category for each, Brent.
Well, they do have a category for each, so that kind of helps. But maybe Orchestra will come out and win the Binary by 7 lengths on Saturday and then come out and win the Oaks by 10. Who knows? But I think you've got to go on numbers. You've got to go on something. You go on volume of Group 1 wins, and what Imperatrice has been able to do has been quite extraordinary. I've been on New Wagon the whole way through. She's the best horse in the country. I don't care what anyone says. And, short of her having complete disaster in the TJ Smith, you would think that she would be there. I don't think there's anything that can emerge to be better than her in terms of overall season performance. Who's the best horse in the country at a given time? That's always a point of debate anyway. So let's see what pans out. But I am very interested in seeing what Orchestral might do on Saturday.
Yeah. And there was no real surprise that James McDonald was booked to ride I Wish I Win. James McDonald was... He wasn't booked for a horse for the TJ Smith for a long time. And you don't have to be Einstein to work what was happening behind the scenes. So,
yeah. Hey, G, on the question, right? So we're not asking who's a horse of the year or anything like that. It's just who's going to be the best racehorse. The best racehorse.
You got about how long we got? 10 seconds.
I'd go with I Wish I Win because I suspect that he'll be winning the TJ Smith and winning it well.
I think it'll be Via Sistina. I think she'll be the best horse in this country by the end of the autumn. And that'll flow into the Brisbane winter. Love your work, Brent.
Thanks, Gareth.
Good on you, Mickey.
Thanks, Jay.